the aflatoxins are produced in the field under conditions of hot weather, hot and dry weather. Oftentimes plants are under drought stress, but even in irrigated agriculture, farmers have seen a problem with aflatoxins. So there's not an issue with water, but it's really high temperatures.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/ag. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm Carlos Campabadal from Kansas State University, dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions from the feed science industry. Please get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode. So today, with great pleasure, we have Dr. Thomas Isakit, who is a professor and extension plant pathologist at Texas A&M. Dr. Isakit, it's a pleasure having you here. Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast.
Thank you.
As we talk a little bit with Dr. Isakit, he is world-renowned specialist in everything related to molds and mycotoxins. So I'm pretty sure that the audience today will get a lot of very good information and that will be very helpful overall for our audience, both domestic and international here. So just to start up, Dr. Isakit, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how your career was developed? And we'll start from that.
So I've been at Texas A&M since 1993 in an extension position working with agronomic crops and some vegetables as well. And I got into plant pathology because I was very interested in solving problems. And just over the course of my undergraduate, graduate career, I was steered into more of an extension position. So not just in a lab, but wanting to take my knowledge and other people's knowledge and communicate it to farmers and other people in agriculture.
So developed plant pathologists working a lot in the field. What are the main crops that you work there or what you have done throughout your career then?
So I'm primarily working with cotton, corn, and sorghum. And in the vegetable world, watermelons.
Oh, watermelons. Okay, so, great.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Texas is a large producer of watermelons. It's a different world between the vegetable and the agronomic crops. Very, very interesting to contrast.
I'm pretty sure I'm a grain person. So, of course, corn and sorghum in my realm, cotton, not too much, and watermelon, totally. You all know that. But we're very happy to hear to learn about that. So, great, perfect. So, as we know here, and for our audience, please like us. Please give us the famous line there, a thumbs up for today's episode. So, we start our discussion here. Plant pathologists, field work, of course, molds, mycotoxins, a lot of issues health-wise, economically, and other issues there. So let's start from the basics for our audience to comprehend a little bit better. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about that in terms of what are mycotoxins and a little bit of targeted there. What are the factors that are involved in their production, where they're produced, and what are the main crops that we have to, or main mycotoxins that we have to worry about from a feed perspective and the crops linked to those?
So mycotoxins are chemicals, poisons produced by fungi, and they tend to be in the environment. And I deal with it from the crop production standpoint, from plants growing in the field. And these fungi can primarily infect crops as they're growing and as they're maturing, produce the mycotoxins. So as I said earlier, I'm really driven by problem solving. And one particular mycotoxin, aflatoxin, can be a chronic problem in Texas, primarily in southern states, but sometimes in the Midwest during drought years. And so the fungus Aspergillus flavus is the Latin name for it. There's other species of Aspergillus that produce aflatoxins as well, but it's very present in the environment. In fact, I tell growers, you'll find it in the soils, you'll find it blowing in the air, but it doesn't cause a problem in the crop unless certain factors are met. And part of it is some sort of injury to the kernel, the corn kernel, for example. If there's a crack, either through an insect injury or even some environmental stress that causes that kernel as it's developing to crack. Otherwise, the fungus cannot get in on its own. The other factors are the environment. The aflatoxins are produced in the field under conditions of hot weather, hot and dry weather. Oftentimes, plants are under drought stress. But even in irrigated agriculture, farmers have seen a problem with aflatoxins. So there's not an issue with water, but it's really high temperatures. And one aspect of that, high temperatures at the time of flowering of the corn produces stress on that predisposes it to aflatoxin contamination. So the fungus gets in, it might sit there in the kernel doing nothing, but once you have the other factors, like the high temperatures, it starts to produce aflatoxin. And actually, as the corn is maturing and dries down, it's producing the aflatoxin to the point where the corn gets to about 18% kernel moisture. In Texas, we tend to let the kernel moisture go down to about 15% before the corn is harvested. I know in the Midwest, they harvested higher moistures
to
dry it down. Some recommendations for management there, and I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but if it looks like there's an aflatoxin problem brewing in the field, an early harvest followed by drying could alleviate the level of contamination. So if it's brought down quickly to 15% kernel moisture or so, the fungus becomes dormant. There's no more aflatoxin produced. On the other hand, if there was aflatoxin produced while it was still in the field, it still is going to be there. That will not be going away.
Perfect. And that's actually where I was going to ask you about that, because, you know, I'm here in Kansas. I work in Indiana, Illinois in the past, and of course with farmers due to my also extension background. And you know, a lot of times you dry it with, you know, high temperature dryers or in-bin dryers, depending. And you know, as you go northern states where, you know, temperature are lower and people tend to keep the grain at a higher moisture just to save a little bit of fuel and then aerate it. But that was always a question if that mold will stay there, of course, but the mycotoxins, especially the afla, will be produced there more than if that grain stays above 15. So that's very good to know, and I'm pretty sure the audience here will have a lot of curiosity on this topic. So bring that for our audience. If you have any questions, please comment there. Put your question in the comment section, and we'll make sure that if something comes up, we'll get it to Dr. Isaacson. So Dr. Isaacson, go into this conversation a little bit. You know, I my background is grain storage, most post-harvest all the way to get it to the consumers or the processors, and then on the feed side too, being one of those processors. And we see, especially in the feed side, a lot of questions and a lot of concerns about aflatoxins, and we understand that from the animal and the human consumption to that there could be health issues. But when you're in the feed industry, my opinion is that people always think about the consequences on the animal and just prevent it with mycotoxin binders. But having your background from a plant pathologist, I think it can help us, for us that are later in that value chain, understand better. So being said that, can you go a little bit more in detail in terms of, so if you have that, the presence of the molds, because let's start with that. Molds in the field that produce maybe the fusariums that go for some mycotoxins, the aspergillus that go for other ones, are they always there in the field? Or they vary year by year? Maybe get a little bit of detailed information about that.
So there's, and this has been studied in the past, but there's a little bit of geographical dominance of certain species. So the aspergillus tends to be found in the southern states. And they've done soil surveys and such. You can find it in the northern, midwestern states. but they're really kind of at low levels. And yet in drought years in the Midwest, that can flare up and become a problem. On the flip side, there's certain fusarium species that are not problems in Texas. Particularly fusarium species, Fusarium graminearum, that produces deoxynivalenol, also known as vomit toxin.
Vomit toxin, yeah.
So this is really a Midwestern problem. I've not seen the symptoms of the fungus. It causes Gibberella ear rot is the name of the disease, and it causes a pinkish coloration on the ears in the field. And you see that, you're very likely to have a problem with DON. And that's just not really present here. I think it really is adapted towards a cooler, more temperate climate. And the same with another fusarium species, Fusarium verticillioides, that produces fumonisin.
Uh-huh.
We see this primarily as a problem in the northern part of the state, the panhandle around Amarillo, in their corn there. And it is a different climate than down here. It's what I think of it as a Midwestern climate.
Okay.
Some years that could be a problem as well. But I've also seen situations here in southern Texas, like south of Houston, where you can have both aflatoxin and fumonisin contamination.
Oh.
And you can have both predisposing factors. For example, the aflatoxin could have set in early during the season because of drought stress. And then later on, just when the corn's drying down and they're getting ready to harvest, it starts to rain. They get periodic rains, frequent rains that prevents the corn from drying down and allows the fungus, the fusarium fungus, to start growing and produce fumonisin.
You know, because as we see it there, at least in the U.S., of course, and in your examples that you're saying, Texas is very geographical, you know, some more in the Midwest, some, but... Being said that, on the mold side, when they're in the field, then would they be any competition for growth between the fusariums and the aspergillus and maybe non-mycotic molds, you know, or their interaction might get them to be like stronger strains or mycotoxins, if that makes sense, on that sense? Because there's always thought about that overall, people that don't have the background.
Okay, so yeah, that's been studied as well. Fusarium species are better competitors than the aspergillus. And for one thing, they can get into an intact kernel. They've got the enzymes that can punch through the seed coat and get in. And they also, there's also a bit of specialization. So the aspergillus fungus grows in the lipid-rich areas, so the aileron and the embryo, whereas the fusarium species can grow in the endosperm. So there's a bit of a separation there. There's also, again, a bit of fusarium would probably grow under cooler temperatures, cooler optimal temperatures. And they would tend to grow first. But you could also see a succession in the kernels that at the higher kernel moistures, quote, relatively high, like 22%. Fusarium does very well in competition with aspergillus. Aspergillus does not do well. It's only when the kernel gets below 20%, the fusarium, it's less optimal for the fusarium species and more optimal for growth of the aspergillus. So there can be some separation that way. But you put them together, the fusarium tends to be the better competitor.
The better competitor. That's interesting, and thank you for sharing that. And then for, of course, of our audience, if you learned something new today, please share the video. We appreciate it when people do that. So going back to that conversation then, would it be a valid point to say, hey, the molds, either fusarium or aspergillus, they stay always in the field, but can they get also transferred, let's say, in the grain to different areas, like let's say inside a bin or a silo for our audience, or can they be also in the air and on the walls of a structure? Just thinking a little bit more for a processor of grain.
Okay, well, you can count on it. You can count that as the farmer's combining, everything is getting mixed up Sometimes if there's a lot of aspergillus ear rot, you might even see little clouds of green coming out of the combine. So the spores are going to be everywhere. It's going to go on the grain. And this is an important point for the people using the grain. If it's dried down to like 15%, it doesn't matter how many spores are on it. Nothing will happen. They'll stay dormant. There will not be any potential for future mycotoxin development unless storage conditions change. And I've seen this with leaky bins. So water gets in, remoistens the grain, you get molds growing again. And that's where you can get mycotoxin production. But normally, if the grain goes in a bin, stored dried, stays dry, that will not become a problem, an issue. And those spores don't last for forever. But of course, for the storage conditions, even a few months is still a long time.
And I was going to ask you, the one that actually, would that be true that only the aspergillus molds can produce aflatoxin or acrotoxin or in storage, that the fusariums only in the field? Would that be a correct concept?
I could see fusarium producing fumonis and DON in storage as well. I mean, I've grown it up on corn kernels in the lab, and I can measure the mycotoxin.
Okay, because I talk about that sometimes from a post harvest management or in a feed mill or an importer that buys U.S. corn or sorghum or even wheat. How they store it in tropical weather, like Southeast Asia or Central America, somewhere on those lines. And there's always a concept that only aflatoxins and acrotoxins can be produced in storage because that's aspergillus. But it's good to know that fusariums can also happen, that because it's important to keep in mind. So at the end, that's a very good concept. You're saying keep your grain dry. Sometimes you get a leaky bean, a bin, or you get a condensation, or store grain with higher moisture contents, and then you get all these issues there. So, very, very important to
understand. I do have an anecdote about that. Getting corn from a chicken producer that was in storage and it was leaky, and the corn had more of a characteristic fusarium type coloration, and I obtained fusarium cultures from it, and they said when they feed their chickens that grain, they have symptoms on the chickens that do not fit aflatoxin.
Ah, okay.
So, but it goes back, well, they could have prevented the problem just by having better storage.
Better storage.
And going back, you mentioned the use of binders and such. They might work better against some mycotoxins, but not others. So yeah, my point, prevent them from being formed in the grain to begin with, and keep that grain secure to prevent that from happening.
Exactly. No, I agree with you. I mean, the better that you do your storage practice, because, coming from the feed world, and I kind of grew up in that world too, everybody's like, oh, I don't worry, I just put my mycotoxin binders. But, they're expensive. At least here in the United States, they are licensed more to sell us an anti-compacting agent. And then abroad, of course, increases several dollars per ton when you're making feed. So I think it's better just to keep your grain dry, good storage practices, and avoid that. There's been studies that show that there's even some nutrient absorption from the binder. So a lot of things that we have to learn, and this podcast is great for that. So, and for our audience, of course, please subscribe to the channel. Click on the bell to receive our notifications about future episodes here. So
Carlos, I'd like to also go back in terms of, again, I and my colleagues want to prevent this problem in the first place in the field. And there's other factors too. I talked about environmental factors, which we really can't control, but there are genetic factors in the grain, in the corn particularly. There are differences in the hybrids in their resistance to environmental stress. We don't have out-and-out resistance to aspergillus or fusarium as much as you have resistance to other common diseases. But typically, if it's an environmental stress issue, if you have a well-adapted hybrid, it tends to resist that kernel cracking. And we have seen that in field tests side by side. Some hybrids are doing better than others in terms of preventing as much aflatoxin accumulation.
And that is very important overall. I didn't think about that, but what you mentioned is, I think, extremely important from a farmer's perspective overall. So being said that, something that I wanted to ask you here, I know you have a lot of experience evaluating fungicides and other products there, but the use of fungicides in the field, would that help with controlling the molds that can produce mycotoxins, or what would be the practice on that sense?
Okay, so there are examples of fungicides being effective for mycotoxin reduction. The big example is DON on wheat, and there's been a lot of research done that shows that association. One of the fungicides that I work that's labeled on corn is Proline. I've done a lot of studies myself with it, small trials, but also large farm scale trials, and at least under our conditions, I've not seen an impact for aflatoxin. At least it might work for monacin. I've not had that stress to see that. The short of it is, you can't really rely on fungicides to do that. Just the way the fungicides work, the way the fungus gets into the kernel, you can't really depend on the fungicides protecting that point where the fungus gets in and starts producing the mycotoxin.
So a fungicide will be more used for the overall plant itself if there's any fungus that could affect for a disease or something around those lines. Okay.
There's one example of a treatment during the field that's very effective for aflatoxin reduction, and that is the use of atoxigenic or non-toxin producing strains of the same fungus. So this is a form of biological control. It was developed by, there's several strains out there developed by USDA plant pathologists, and they've been on the market for, over 12 years, and they really have made an impact. We've done surveys of farmers in Texas, and most growers will, if they're in an area that has an aflatoxin problem, will use it. It's pretty slick how it works. It's just earlier in the season, just before flowering, the farmers will apply the atoxigenic strain, which is usually carried as spores on dehulled barley or sorghum that's not viable. So, you know, it's just a food base for the fungus.
Okay.
And the fungus germinates, grows, produces more spores, and these spores swamp that environment. So normally the toxin-producing strains, you don't have a blanket of them in the field. It's just here and there, very sporadic, and they produce their spores and get around. And you see that in terms of the amount of colonization. Most corn kernels do not become contaminated. It's just a very small number that do, but those can be very highly contaminated and lead to an overall average high level of aflatoxin. But anyways, these atoxigenic strains, there's so much more of the spores out there, and they tend to get into the cracked kernels of the corn and colonize it first. And you do not have the replacement of what's already in there. Technical term for this is competitive exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever gets in there first occupies that territory. And if most of the strains are an atoxigenic aspergillus, they're there. And they don't really cause any visible disease. Most of the time, the aflatoxin contamination is invisible. Sometimes you'll see ear rot or green ears and such, but most of the time you can have really good looking grain. Then you measure the aflatoxin and you have a high amount. And that's because of microscopic colonization and production of the aflatoxin in that grain. But anyways, the atoxigenic strains have exactly the same requirements as the toxin producing ones.
Mm, okay.
So they're perfect competitors as a control.
It is very, very interesting, and I think that's from agronomic, you know, farming practice. And I came across a similar concept, but I didn't know the details that you just explained, which is great. There was a project, USAID, when it existed several years ago, funded in Kenya, called the AFLA test. There was something like that. That was part of that was to help the farmers measure aflatoxins, but also how to put fungus, that mold spores that competed against in the fields there.
Yes, that's being used in Africa. It's important there because aflatoxin be a big problem with human consumption in Africa with the subsistence farmers.
Yeah, and I look at it. I used to manage a project in Guatemala for USAID there on the post-harvest loss innovation lab, Feed the Future lab, and we try to move it to Guatemala and Honduras. The project ran out before we put in that idea, but very interesting overall from a plant pathology perspective and overall. So
one more point about the atoxigenics. It's very good for aflatoxin, not necessarily good for other mycotoxins. And as I explained earlier, you know, Fusarium is a better competitor than Aspergillus. And this also applies to the atoxigenic strain.
That's good to know. I was going to ask you actually for the other Fusarium based mycotoxins and how that would work. And so being said that, another concept is that, you know, when you are a feed miller or, you know, even a flour mill, that you see your grain with mold, not necessarily has mycotoxins, but those non-toxic molds, what will be the issue with them? If once you have already harvested grain, it will be more like a spoilage of the grain, bad odors type of deal, or something that we have to look more into the disease type of toxicity or something around those lines?
Well, yeah, I don't really deal too much with other species, but I would say they'd affect the grain quality and such, but I can't say we know what all the mycotoxins that exist. They're always finding new ones.
Yes.
But like, for example, Penicillium ear rot and the growth of the Penicillium fungus on the corns. And Penicillium species are known to produce mycotoxins, but in corn, there's no toxin problem known to be related to that. Rhizopus or some of the black spore fungi. They're also Diplodia is also an ear rotting fungus, can cause a lot of yield loss just from that decay of the grain, but it's not known to produce any mycotoxins.
Okay, that's good to know. So based on that, will there be any grain that is more vulnerable compared to others if you're in the same location? More vulnerable to mycotoxins just because of its structure or something around those lines, or easier for that mold to get in?
Well, it's related to tolerance of environmental stress. And we've seen actually other species of fungi in hybrids that were not developed for high temperatures in South Texas, like Midwestern hybrids. And if you transplant them down here, they're susceptible to everything, and they also have a problem with yield. So that's one aspect of the management, just a well-adapted hybrid for your growing area. Make sure it's been tested out.
That's good to know. And that's what's important of understanding the science of hybrids. And I think that's another episode here of this podcast, but I think it's something that is important for our audience to understand.
It's time for our famous three.
Evonik Animal Nutrition is committed to ensure food security and safety while reducing the ecological footprint of animal farming. Its products and services use evidence-based solutions that seek to promote animal welfare and reduce reliance on natural resources. All this is underpinned by long-standing industry partnerships and deep customer understanding. Evonik's focus on efficiency, sustainable, healthy nutrition, and collaborations with livestock farming partners creates value for customers and consumers.
So we're coming to the end of the podcast, but I know we talk about grain, of course, being the Feed Science podcast, but I'm pretty sure that tell us a little bit about watermelons. Any issues with mycotoxins? I know you have done some work in watermelons, so maybe something to understand there a little bit of what are the main issues that we have to look into it, or is more a fungus type of problem?
Oh, there's all sorts of fungal diseases on watermelons, but they do not have mycotoxin problems. And a lot of times when I get a ripe watermelon into the lab and I examine it for a bacterial pathogen, I'll cut out the affected part, and the rest of it is consumable. As long as, and this is I guess for everyone who consumes watermelon, if it looks good, it's not rotting or smelly, it's edible.
Okay.
So that's been my experience. But a lot of times there are certain diseases that happen in the field, like fungal infections, and they don't really see a problem on the fruit. And then when the fruit gets shipped out to the final destination during that time in shipment, it develops as a post-harvest problem. You have really rotten fruit that the buyer at the other end rejects the load. Yeah, this is all bad. And it's an aesthetic issue. A lot of times, if it looks bad, people won't buy it. And I don't blame for that. I understand what the risks are. There's other times if it looks moldy, better to not eat it.
Exactly. Yeah. But, my family, we love watermelons. I mean, it's just here in Kansas, so the season is a little bit shorter compared to other places, but we try to always get them and, you know, make juices and things like that. So it's important to know. So I think this is great. We're coming to the end of our overall podcast, great information. And of course, for our audience, please visit our site, wisenetics.com, and learn more about all of the other podcast segments that we have, like the poultry, swine, dairy, beef, and of course, pet food. Before we end this podcast, Dr. Isaac, I want to ask you something a little bit more. If for our audience, if they wanted to learn more a little bit about molds and mycotoxins, what would be a resource that you will recommend them, or a book or a website, something that they could go and learn on their own?
This has been my recommendation for people specifically growing crops, but go to your state university's website, like ksu.edu, and look for there's information on plant diseases for specific crops that is written in more of a layman's term. It's not technical, but any kind of extension information, bulletins and such would be a good starting point. I've worked a lot with Master Gardeners, and then that's a pretty good program. I've given talks on plant disease diagnosis, and there are that you might be able to find some free materials out there that just describe the nature of plant diseases and give specific examples.
No, perfect. And, we understand Texas A&M, big university, graduating great professionals, both at the undergrad and grad level. In your opinion, to wrap up, what sets a successful professional, let's say in plant pathology, apart from those who are not? And that just for more for our younger audience are there and maybe in the university or grad school to learn about somebody with experience so they could succeed in their future career.
Well, one aspect that I think the highest aspect is being very dedicated to the consumer, the customer, the farmer, be it as, and being dedicated to helping them. So that would be the main quality to have. And I'm trying to teach students to be really skeptical and think through questions scientifically and issues and alternative explanations for things, just to be, on the other hand, to be open-minded, but on the other hand, to be very critically thinking about it. And I'm going to harp one more time on the aflatoxin thing, because some growers we're saying that, well, if you put your contaminated grain in storage, it'll go away, or the cold will go away. It doesn't make sense from what I understand about how it's done, but it's possible to do experiments to test it out. The bottom line, there's no evidence that it works. And moreover, when people have given these anecdotes, it's been really a difference in how they sampled. And the sampling is a whole nother talk about how this works, but there's alternative explanations for why they can't find aflatoxin in a small sample that they've taken out.
And I'm very happy you brought that in. And I was going to bring it before, but we could carry it a little bit in the conversation, which was great. One of the things that I do is actually teach people in the feed mills and in the grain elevators on sampling, try to reduce your variability, your right lot size, representative composite samples, because you're right. A lot of people say, hey, I had it and I had any more. It's like, well, you're not hidden where it is, but, you know, so you have to think about those things. So thank you very much for bringing that up. And thank you for all the recommendations on the extension bulletins and the recommendation for future professionals there to be dedicated and skeptical, critical thinking. I think that's great advice. So with that, thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Isaacid. And for our audience, this concludes another episode of the Feed Science Podcast brought to you by Wisenetics. Thank you for joining us today. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review because your feedback is very valuable for us. Until next time, this is Carlos Campabadal from the Feed Science Podcast signing off. Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.